The Glenn Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Institute. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber at glennlowry.substack.com. As a subscriber, you will receive new episodes on Mondays instead of Fridays and get access to exclusive content, ticket pre-sales to live events, monthly Q&As with Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, and other benefits. Your contribution will also help to fund grassroots initiatives that empower Black development across the country as we donate 10% of our profits to the Woodson Center. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. This is Glenn Lowry. Thanks for tuning in to The Glenn Show. I'm a professor at Brown University and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research in New York City, which sponsors The Glenn Show. And I'm with John McWhorter, who teaches at Columbia University and writes for The New York Times and is my bi-weekly conversation partner here. Every other week, John and I will kick it around. We're joined this week by Keith Ellison, who is the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, and who in that capacity oversaw the trial of police officer Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. In 2021 was the trial, and 2020 was the crime. And he's the author of a book, Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence, which is a chronicle of the fight for justice, quoted from the cover of the book, and the murder trial of George Floyd. Keith has petitioned us to read his book and to come on the show and to talk about it because John and I have had several conversations here about the murder of George Floyd and the trial of Derek Chauvin. We, just to remind you, if you don't know out there in the audience, interviewed the filmmakers of the documentary film The Fall of Minneapolis, which is a passionate defense of the police in not only the killing of George Floyd, but also in the general conflict between police and community around police violence in the city of Minneapolis. The film, The Fall of Minneapolis, was produced and directed by Liz Collins and J.C. Chase, who are principals in the, in Minneapolis that, anyway, they put out the film. We talked to them. It's controversial. They claim that Derek Chauvin was railroaded and wrongly convicted of the crime that Keith is proud to be able to say he oversaw the prosecution and successful conviction of. And Keith wants to talk to us. We want to talk to him. We're happy that he wants to talk to us. Some people call us conservatives, John. I know you chafe at that. Keith still doesn't, and you may want to speak for yourself here and disavow everything I'm about to say. My memoir is coming out, Late Admissions, Confessions of a Black Conservative. So I'm on record as, to some degree, embracing that label. I'm happy that Keith is, who's a man of the left, as I understand him, he's a Democrat, he's a former member of Congress, he's a quote-unquote liberal. And again, correct me if I say anything wrong, Keith, but happy that you're willing
notice
to cross
you,
the...
Notice you. Yeah,
that you're willing to cross the partisan divide and share with us. And we very much appreciate it. And you've given us some time and we can dig into the details of it. John, you want to add anything to that intro?
Actually, that was good. Except I would say that I am a liberal and not just a classical liberal, but a liberal. I'm not a leftist. And I have noticed in my career, such as it is, as a race commentator, that to have views of mine is called conservative, but there's very little overlap between my views and those of people who are conservative in terms of the dictionary definition. I think that we informally tend to think that a certain group of views make a Black person, although not other people, conservative, where conservative becomes a kind of a stand-in label for suspicious, possibly a sellout, not understanding the prevalence of racism, that sort of thing. And so people call me conservative partly because I wear cardigan sweaters and I talk like this, but really, I'm a liberal. I'm just not a leftist, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Sounds good to me, John.
What do you want us to know about the trial of Derek Chauvin and the subsequent discussion of it that most concerns you?
Well, first I want to say we can discuss anything you want, but to me, it is simply a false statement to say that Derek Chauvin and Thomas Lane and J. Alexander King and Tu Tao did not together kill George Floyd. It is a medical fact that that happened. Derek Chauvin and all of them were amply represented by counsel. They had the full panoply of rights. They won many motions. They brought any expert they wanted to bring in. And we proved beyond a reasonable doubt to a fair and impartial jury that they were guilty of second degree unintentional murder and third degree murder, which was later dismissed through the appellate process, but also the murder two stuck. And so he's guilty of two crimes, and the two lower ones are subsumed within the most serious one. The other three pled guilty. Tu Tao didn't exactly plead guilty, but he waived his right to a trial and submitted all the documents to the judge, and the judge found him guilty, which is more or less saying, I'm guilty, but I don't want to say so out of my own mouth. They went to trial in federal court, found guilty there. Derek Chauvin was found guilty in federal court. Derek Chauvin was found guilty in federal court. Then the other three went to trial and lost in federal court. And you guys may know that the jury pool in federal court is like all of southern Minnesota, which is, you know, which is much more rural than Hennepin County, which is where the Chauvin case was tried, much more white than Hennepin County. And in federal court, the judge does all the voir dire, meaning all the jury selection. So there's no way to really manipulate the jury. So what I'm saying is, you can say that the city should have been better prepared. Fine. You can say that there's a lot of good cops. I actually agree with you on that. But if anybody says that Derek Chauvin is not responsible for the murder and death of George Floyd, well, Derek Chauvin says otherwise. And if you look at all the evidence that we showed, clearly he is responsible. If you look at Dr. Tobin, the world leading pulmonologist, Dr. Rich, cardiologist, several toxicologists, it is absolutely clear. Now, some people think, oh, well, he was killed because of the knee on the neck. That became just a shorthand for what happened. Really, it was not just the knee on the neck. It had to do with the compression of his chest cavity into the concrete. It had to do with his knee on the neck. And it had to do with the fact that his legs were held and he could not, you know, your lungs have a bellow effect. Breathe in, breathe out. And you've got to get a certain amount of oxygen into your body. And if you can't, you're going to die. And it's going to take maybe no more than 5 minutes. Long after he didn't have a pulse, they did not do any medical intervention, even they were trained to do so. And, you know, he was probably dead on the scene. So I just want you guys to know, oh, did the mayor do all he could have done? I don't know. There's a whole lot of reasons to discuss and debate what happened. But what happened in terms of George Floyd being murdered by Derek Chauvin and Thomas Lane and J. Alexander King and Tu Tao, that is a non-starter. Anyone who says it didn't happen is deliberately uttering falsehoods for the purpose of disinforming the public. And I know that last thing is harsh, but I believe it to be true. Because if you can look on YouTube and see the trial. The trial was televised internationally. So, you know, the only appellate issues that were really had any level of viability, they all failed, by the way, but the only ones that were even worth talking about was the jury exposed to too much pretrial publicity? Yeah. And the court decided, well, you know, look, everybody in the world knew about it. There's no jurisdiction you could go to. So you had to do it. You might as well do it in Minneapolis if you're going to do it anywhere. You can't legally move to another state. You've got to stay within the state of Minnesota. And you're not going to change people's level of awareness. but you may change their attitude about who and what George Floyd deserves, right? You can change the jersey. You can shop for attitudes, but you can't shop for impartiality because everybody saw it.
Keith, this is a genuine question. All of that is clearly, you can't deny any of it. Had Chauvin done that neck thing on lots of other people before?
Yeah, he did, okay. But they didn't die.
Okay, and so, the other people didn't die. And so I think, therefore, we know that not only was it unintentional, but he would have been very surprised that it had that result. He was responsible, certainly, but he had done it before. This is the other thing I want to mention. I see all of this as a conversation that has played out where Glenn and I saw that documentary, and it turns out that the documentary was misleading in many ways. That seems quite clear, but it was also very well made. It was a brilliant argument. It was like Ciceronian oratory. They did a good job of what they were trying to do. So then we talk about it.
Isn't good propaganda always high quality?
Yeah, they did. And so then we talk about it. And you find out, and you bring us more evidence. Like, you bring us the real deal. And both of us say, oh, wait a minute. Huh. And so then, you know, you have this battle between Coleman Hughes and Rodney Balco, et cetera.
I just want to ask Keith, does he know about the Coleman Hughes and Rodney Balco exchange? These are two commentators.
I do know a little bit about it, but I didn't read all of their material. I know that they had a dispute. And I know that the man who made the original assertions got rebutted by Balco, and Balco came with some very important clarifying facts.
Hughes, the young critic who made the original pro-police intervention that Balco rebutted. Sorry to interrupt, John.
I haven't had the pleasure of meeting him. Don't know the man and I'm not familiar with his writings, but now I am. And I'll try to get a little smarter about who Coleman Hughes is.
Take a look at him this last week on The View, where he kicked ass. Frankly, he was so cool, and he took care of himself with that goddamn Sonny Hostin. It was really, very, really well done. And so anyway, I was just going to say, we've been learning truth. But frankly, in that very well-made documentary, especially when it turns out that Floyd said, I can't breathe, long before he was anywhere near the ground, that's a very complex moment. Like, when somebody makes a play about this, I hope that they include that. Because it looks like he was kind of using that as a line. It's become kind of a line since Eric Garner. But it could also be taken as that he was practically suffocating while standing up. I make no apology for having been distracted by that. And now you have given more truth, but there was nothing wrong with me and Glenn talking about it. That's my feeling. Anyway, go ahead.
And John, let me call you. I'm not on your show today to tell you how wrong you were and how bad you are.
I know.
I'm here to say, you heard that side. Now hear this. And it's sort of adding to, and this is a testament to your fairness, quite honestly. As I was telling Glenn before you were getting on, you must know that I'm familiar with Liz Collins. I don't know the other gentleman. I don't know Mr. J.C. Chait, but I do know Liz Collins because she's married to a fellow by the name of Bob Kroll, who's the former head of the Minneapolis Police Union. And let me tell you how I met her husband, Bob Kroll. When I was elected to Congress in 2006, he was talking to a group of police officers, only police officers in the room. And he says the people of Minneapolis are pretty dumb. They were at war with the terrorists, and they just elected one to Congress. A black woman by the name of Gwen Gunther raised her hand and said, are you saying that Congressman Ellison is a terrorist? And he goes on something about, I didn't mean it that way, I didn't say it that way, but he is one of them. And, like, you know, end up being that Chief Dolan has to apologize to me publicly. So what I'm trying to share with you is, Liz Collins is clearly not just conservative, because, you know, conservative could well be interpreted to mean you believe in the old tried and true ways. You believe in, like, what your mama taught you, save your money, be honest, all that. And that's cool. And that's who raised me. My dad was conservative in that way. But Liz Collins is what I call like a new conservative, really, really, you know, hostile and suspicious of anything Black people are trying to do. Justifies anything. I mean, can't see police misconduct from what I can see. Can't imagine that there's such thing. And I just want to tell you, I'm a firm believer that police officers do. I know too many good cops to try to broad brush them all. But I also believe that we should have high standards for policing. And we should fire bad police. And we should criminally prosecute criminal police. And I don't think she believes that. I don't think she thinks any such thing as that exists. Her husband had about 27 some excessive force complaints against him. Some pretty bad. And yet she's totally comfortable with that, apparently. And so she makes this movie. And so my thought is so you guys may not know all that background, but I know it.
And I know so it now. I didn't know it at the time. I know it in part thanks to Radley Balco's extensive coverage of this. I didn't know it at the time.
Let me tell you guys, it is true that we have rape, murder, and robbery going on in our streets and community. We have too many shootings. We do rely on members of law enforcement to help maintain safety. That includes prosecutors. I'm a prosecutor. But we also have people who don't live up to the standards of the job, who abuse their authority, who abuse it on a racialized basis sometimes, not all the time. We are aware of what happened to Tyre Nichols, right? And it's nothing wrong with saying that we should have high standards in policing and that people who don't want to adhere to the standards of that badge should not be in the field.
Keith, just for the record, though, I get it. Why do you think the people in question are doing all this raping and looting and all this stuff? Is it white people's fault? This is a sidebar. So, what do you think?
Because white people do most of the raping, looting, and robbing and shooting in our country.
No.
I get your question.
In a Black community, yeah. Not just numerical. Why are they doing that?
I think there's a few elements. One is, it does go back to the universal, John, for me. I mean, why did Bernie Madoff rip off billions of dollars from thousands of people? Because he wanted to. It's the malevolence of the evil of the wicked heart. At some point, that is the explanation for Black crime, white crime, Asian crime, any crime, right? But I would say that when it comes to the Black community, I can't get through 250 years of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of disparity. Don't tell me these events are not related to each other. Sometimes what you have in the Black community is over-policing. So, for example, you all know, crack cocaine in the United States, there are whole states where no white person was ever charged with crack. None. And so, like, is that? So now we want to say, the Black folks are into crack. Well, no, whoa. The CDC says that everybody uses dope. But you only look for drug addicts in this neighborhood. Now, that is a driver. Let me also say that Black people are overwhelmingly represented in the exonerated, John. What does that mean? That means there's a lot of Black people convicted of crimes that they didn't commit. Think of the Central Park Five. Now, none of this am I saying. Now, John, look here. Hold on. I'm not saying Black people don't commit crime. I'm saying Black people commit crime for the same reason everybody else commit crime. But I'm also saying, given our nation's racial history and past, that we are also unfairly targeted for law enforcement, particularly in the war on drugs. If you go back to, like, just use rape for a minute. How many Black men between 1865 and 1925 actually raped some white woman?
Oh, you know, they didn't. One, I don't know.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that part of why you have Black criminality is just some people are just, they don't care about others and they only care about themselves.
Keith, very quickly, what I fail to understand, and I really mean it's something that always perplexes me. I hear everything you're saying. You are more moved in your gut by Liz Collins and Derek Chauvin and the kind of discrimination that you're talking about, that moves you more than the fact, and I'm sure you're aware of this fact, yes, there are evil people everywhere, but in the typical American city where there's a significant number of Black people, Black men commit a vastly disproportionate number of homicides. Vastly disproportionate, mostly upon each other, but that doesn't exonerate it. The issue is not white people kill white people and Black people kill Black people. Why do Black people kill so many Black people? It seems to me that that doesn't bother you very much. I'm politely asking you why.
No, let me just tell you this. I think that you're incorrect about that. I think, here's the thing. There's a difference between law enforcement committing murder and private citizens committing murder. What's sure. the difference? One is, one has the imprimatur of the state. And the other is a criminal who again, let me remind you, bro.
I've never understood this argument.
Say again?
I've heard that. I've never understood it. I don't get it. Maybe I lack legal training or something. And it's always imprimatur.
No, you don't need legal training. You don't need legal training. It's just, take a line from Ghostbusters. If a private citizen commits a crime, who are you going to call? The police. What if the police commit a crime? Now you're calling on the agents of the state who have a responsibility and obligations under the Fourth Amendment, right? And so it is, to me, more negatively impactful for
democracy. Miss Jackson doesn't care about that when her son gets killed. I don't get it.
But you're answering a question that's really not. You're asking a good question, but that's not the question. You're asking me, why is it that one kind of recurrent killing gets attention and another doesn't get nearly as much? But here's the thing, John, you don't live in Minneapolis, so what you don't know is that I prosecute murderers all the time, man. Every day and all the time.
Your heart doesn't seem to bleed.
Why does it need to? Well, how do you know, though, John? I mean, here's the problem.
Tell us then, because, and by the way, Alpha News is the name of the organization that produced that documentary that I couldn't think of a minute ago. John is talking about affect. You know, he's talking about passion.
No, no.
He's talking about leadership. And when we're facing such violence in our own community committed by our own people, we look to someone like you, an African-American elected official, to frame that issue in a way that puts some responsibility on the community to address what's going on among ourselves, regardless of whether or not it's caused in some long historical story by slavery and Jim Crow and whatnot. And how do you react to that?
Well, I'll be happy to react to it. But if you ask me why people dying at the hands of law enforcement have an obligation to safeguard those same people, and why I have another kind of emotional reaction when a private citizen commits a crime against another private citizen, the answer is, one has a systemic problem with solving, and the other does not have a systemic problem with solving. So, in other words, there was recently, if you guys got any kind of ability to search anything right now, search the name Zaria McKeever, Zaria McKeever. You can look it up right now if you're able. What you'll find is that a man who was an adult organized two teenagers to go into the home of his ex girlfriend and father of his child, and he organized them, supplied them with guns, brought them, gave them a ride, gave them material clothing so they could obscure their identity. And they broke into her house and they were looking for the boyfriend to harm. He ran out of the back. She tried to calm the two guys down because they knew the two shooters were after the boyfriend. And they shot her 6 times and murdered her. Now, the local prosecutor was going to say, because juveniles don't have enough brain development, we're going to treat them within the juvenile system. I listened to the victim. I listened to the family. I listened to the Black churches. And I went to the governor and I said, Governor, you have the authority to hand me this case. And I took that case and we're prosecuting those people right now. Now, you guys, don't know about that case because you're not from Minnesota. But let me tell you, listening to what happened to that family and that young woman, that wonderful young woman, is moving me forward from an emotional point of view. I took that case, got myself in trouble with a bunch of other prosecutors because they don't like the AG taking their cases. And I don't plan on taking their cases. But that case, I could not abide. And the community that that young woman, I mean, look, the family, if that case would have went down, if that kid would have got 18 to 24 months of juvenile, he would have been in the line at Target with that girl's father in a short period of time. He represents a terror to the community, to the family. I took that case, I prosecuted. Here's another one. I didn't even take this case criminal. I took this case civil. There's a young woman named Wiley. Her name is, her last name is Wiley. Beautiful young woman. And she was just out partying. She's a veterinary technician. And she was shot, Markeisha Wiley. And she was at a party and some idiots started shooting at each other. Yeah, they were African-American guys. She catches a bullet. She's not even a target. Now, one of the guns that ends up shooting with her on the scene is a gun that was sold by a straw purchaser. What is that? That's somebody who has a clean record, who buys guns from a legitimate source and sells them to criminals. But in my opinion, this guy had bought so many guns from the same store that they should have been on notice that they were negligently selling guns. And the end result was harm to people on that scene, including Markeisha Wiley. So, you know, I'm holding them accountable. So I'm just telling you that you guys are media savvy. You know that not everything important is in the media and not everything in the media is important. And so, yes, I do believe that we must prosecute and hold accountable people who commit heinous crimes. I believe that there is a disproportionate impact. And if you want to talk about somebody who's, here's racism. The
Keith,
inattention.
I have to interrupt you briefly for a second. Can you tell us about a time when you were involved with a case where it was white guys who took out a bunch of guns at a party and somebody named Kaylee caught a bullet? Does that ever happen?
Well, if I ever had...
Do you notice that it doesn't? This is what I'm saying. I mean, I'm sure it's happened, but it's much more.
You got to agree with me. Nearly every mass shooting, not all, but most mass shootings are white guys, right?
You're stepping away from my question. I'm talking about this party scenario, which unfortunately is endemic in the Black community. Yes, if somebody does a mass shooting, it's almost always a white guy. That's true. But I'm talking about Kaylee getting killed at a party with a bunch of, you know, white guys. And you know you've never dealt with a case like that. And I'm just saying that is worrisome to me as the things that you're talking about. And I just can't bring myself to associate that disproportion with slavery, Jim Crow, and redlining. There comes a point when you're wondering, what do we do about it now? That's all.
Is there anything going on in Black culture and the nature of our community, in fatherless homes and in the values that kids are embracing, in gang culture and so forth like that? I mean, I'm just asking.
Well, let me just tell you this, man. I think that if you want to fix the problem, there's other more effective places to start. And I think if you want to talk about fatherless homes, that there's some real things we can do about it. But for me, here's where you guys and me probably do kind of separate. And that is, fatherless homes are a tragedy because I grew up in a house with a father. My dad is 95 and I might go get on a plane to Detroit to see him soon. And so I grew up in an intact family. And so, you know, that's a lucky, very fortunate, blessed, you know, situation.
95. Wow.
Right. Yeah. But my point is, I don't think that if you want to talk about African-American dysfunction and violent crime, I believe that there are other more effective things to do in the short term. Let's talk about, let's start with school absenteeism. You know, we've had a dramatic increase in auto thefts in the last few years, right?
Yeah.
And we also know that a lot of the thieves are young. And we also know that a lot of them are not back in school. And we know that because of the digital divide, there were kids who didn't have any school-related structure since 2020. Now, we did have a worldwide pandemic, which I don't think the government should or could have ignored, but it did have residual impacts, particularly in this area. I think if you could get school absenteeism down and get kids back in the classroom, no matter what, even if they're not learning that much, there is a socialization and structuring that will put a damper on juvenile crime and will save lives in many areas, including in starting, and let's talk about auto thefts, for example. There are things that we can do, like even school lunch will draw kids back to school. School breakfast will draw back them to school. We have a real serious housing shortage in nearly every city. I believe that if maintained, public housing is a good alternative. Now, a lot of people grew up in public housing and say, oh, public housing is terrible. I'm like, yeah, because it's poorly maintained. But what I'm saying is if you maintain it, you give kid a stable home, bam, you can improve the quality of life of that kid. I believe school, you guys are really going to hate me saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I believe in school integration. I believe that we should integrate schools. I believe they have better outcomes.
Wait, we're not against that, man. I mean, John can speak for himself on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so let me just tell you, man, there's a good dude named Rucker Johnson. He's an academic, and I think y'all ought to read his work. What he shows is that if you segregate schools, and a lot of these charters are segregation academies, in my view, then you compare them to integrated schools, then you're not only going to improve better outcomes for Black kids, you're going to improve better social outcomes for all kids. And you're going to have an America where people feel much more like each other's fellow citizen than if you have this formative experience that was only this way or that way.
I hit a wall.
So that's
on
your
that.
Take on charters? Charters are bad because they segregate kids?
Well,
what about
charters?
All the evidence that charters raise the test scores of the kids and that the kids in the waiting
all
line who don't get
together,
into the charters do so much worse than the
watching
kids?
Watching each
do?
Other excel? Wow, that is hard for me to think past, Keith. Wow.
Well, let me just tell you, man.
I didn't know that's what you mean.
No, what I mean is if we had not abandoned the drive for school desegregation, and if we coupled it with residential integration as well and just fair housing, right, we would be in a better – we would have a more unified society with better Black student outcomes than we did now. We abandoned this experiment in about the mid-1970s. Certainly by 80, we were done with it. And it has not helped our country. We would be better off if we fulfilled the promises of Brown. And when it comes to when they said that you had to integrate schools in Virginia, they closed out everybody's school, right? And what I'm saying
a
is
a long time ago, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. But you know what? I think it's within the lifetime of at least one out of three people on this call. I personally remember the big fights in Boston, in other places.
I came across a study the other day that surprised me. It was the first study I've ever seen that resoundingly confirmed that busing ever did any real good. I used to not be aware of a single study that showed that it helped. And by accident, I found one the other day and I thought, wow, there actually is a study that shows that somehow what happened in Massachusetts was a good thing for at least some people. But that's not enough evidence for me. I think that was, I would have initiated that experiment. I can tell why people thought it should have been done, but I'm not sure it helped any Black lives in enough of a way for all of that agita and tension, racist whether it was or not, to have been worth it.
Read Rucker Johnson.
I will.
I'd say read Johnson. And so here's the thing. Walk with me for a second. If you say that this group of people, Blacks, for example, must live in a certain part of the city, then if school is basically you go to the schools you're close to, then we can reduce the quality of your education because we control where you live. We can control, who polices your neighborhood. We can control everything. And so this segregation actually put African Americans in a position where, my view, we were subject to greater just whims and winds of the society as they wanted to control the community. You know, the so-called ghetto for white society was not a so much of a problem as it was a solution. What I'm saying to you is, if you want to talk about Black criminality, you isolate people, you confine them, you limit their opportunity spatially, and you're going to have certain outcomes.
Well, wait a minute. You talk as if it's a conspiracy where some external force is forcing people to live. Well, people are voting with their feet. People, including Black people, are voting with their feet. This is one of William Julius Wilson's points from way back when, where Black, upperly mobile and middle class people moving out of concentrated poverty areas and so forth. That Milliken versus Bradley Supreme Court case that limited the ability to impose cross-boundary busing. You know, it's not like there's an evil force in the world that's making the segregation. It's a consequence of complex historical dynamics.
But John, Glenn, redlining was done and sponsored by the FHA. Bro.
Keith, you're not going to like this, but I got to step in here. Most people who were redlined were white. Talk about a conspiracy. It's almost as if people don't want us to know that. Most redlining affected poor white people. There's studies that show it. I wrote a piece about it in the Times a couple years ago. And the white people who were redlined did not magically start doing the sorts of things that we're talking about just because they were all corralled together in lousy neighborhoods. A disproportionate number of Black poor people were redlined, but most of that affected very white people.
But are you denying that redlining did not affect Black people?
It affected Black people in that it wasn't fair, but it doesn't explain what you're calling the criminality. Because most people who were redlined didn't become criminals in that proportion.
But look, those same white people, there was never any laws that they couldn't read. There was never any laws that they didn't have. They weren't impacted by lynching. Lynching is decidedly racialized. No, I commend both you guys to go down to the Equal Justice Institute and have Brian Stevenson give you a tour. I think it will blow your mind down in Montgomery. So you're talking about racial terrorism coupled with all these things. So, you know, I'm not aware of this study that says that white people were redlined and racially segregated. Now, let me just tell you, though, but like, you know, Smith v. Allwright, the end of the Wright primary, you know, the United States Supreme Court had to say that racial covenants were illegal, right? Then voting, then you couple all these things together. I'm not saying that nothing bad ever happened to anybody white. As a matter of fact, let me just remind you, I represent a state where 85% of my constituents are white. I talk to white people in pain every day and all the time. There's no question about it. I think we should discuss it more. But my point is, if you're talking about why do Black people, why are they associated with elevated levels of violent crime? I'm telling you that I think that it's far more complicated than some conservatives, I'm not speaking for you guys, want to imply. I'm saying that when you couple all of these and compound these experiences together, redlining, voting denial, lynching, I mean, you end up in a certain kind of situation. Let me tell you, if you live in Indiana, for many decades, the whole state was controlled by the Ku Klux Klan.
The last official lynching was in Indiana, actually.
That's not Black fathers. That's the Klan. So I think that, look, I'm not saying that the whole thing about family dynamics don't have an important role in the conversation. I'm saying that we overplay it. And we don't look at what the larger society is doing. And Glenn, you were saying, Keith, are you saying there's a conspiracy? I'm saying that, you know, yeah, there's all kind of racial conspiracies in our country. The Chinese Exclusion Act was about the Chinese. Japanese internment was Japanese. Okay. Immigration was, I mean, you know, Jim Crow was about denial of Black people. So we can. So I know we live in a moment where, you know, Ron DeSantis don't want to talk about that, but it's in the historical record, and it is a critical part of how we solve these problems to take it in consideration.
Glad to give you the opportunity to so effectively express your point of view, which I don't think I share or John, but I respect it. I want to ask you about policing again.
Let's go.
Because one of the things that really did strike me about that documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis, was their accounting of the burning to the ground of the 3rd Precinct headquarters and of the demoralization that had on the cops. And of course, Keith, I agree with you. Bad cops need to be held accountable, full stop. Nothing else to say about that. They're subject to the law just like anybody else. And, you know, more power to you for enforcing the law against bad cops when the law so requires. But the morale of the police department is not an insignificant thing. And letting that police station be burnt to the ground was a horrible thing for me to witness. And I just wonder how you feel about it.
Yeah, that was extremely unfortunate. And it was horrible, quite honestly. And it definitely shook a lot of people in Minneapolis when to see that.
These people keep telling me it wasn't burnt to the ground. What are the facts on that? I really don't know.
It was burnt to the point where no human being could survive if you were inside of it at the burning. It was burnt to the point.
Yeah.
Well, put it like this. Are there some bricks standing on top of other bricks? Yes.
But it was burned to the ground.
Yeah, okay. It was burned beyond any and all functionality. You can't rebuild it. It wasn't like there was a fire in one or two rooms.
Okay.
They burned it down. But I will say this. The people who did it were prosecuted and are serving sentences now, and that is extremely important. And I don't think any of them were Black. Maybe one of them was, but several of them were not. You know, I mean, and some of them were not even from Minnesota.
It's always like that.
This situation attracted extremely negative people who wanted to foment pain, suffering, and crazy and chaos. You know, and I think they wanted to do it for a lot of reasons, but one of them was the peaceful protest of what happened to George Floyd, in my view, was righteous. How do you tarnish the peaceful First Amendment protected raising of voices, say this abuse of government power is wrong? Well, you infiltrate the group and you do things that the group will be held responsible for. So I thought that was very bad. And so I think it was a horrible thing. Let me just tell you.
Excuse me for interrupting. I just want to understand you. You're saying pro-police elements infiltrated the anti-police mob.
No,
thank you.
Because I don't think the Boogaloo Boys are pro-police. I think they're pro-chaos.
Okay.
You follow? So let me be clear. No way I'm saying that these people were in favor of the police. What they're in favor of is fomenting a chaotic, crazy situation.
Okay, so they're anarchists.
You know what? I know anarchists who would never do anything violent like that. But I would say that they are people who want disorder. You know?
Where are you on Antifa?
Look, man, Antifa is not so much of a group as it is a movement. And it is a movement of like 100 years ago. It means anti-fascism. And I think that it is a term that right wing has lifted up to sort of like create boogeymen. So like they're saying Antifa's responsible for January 6th. No, it isn't. Right? Now, look, you know, I think that... they're not big enough to make a big deal about. I think if they commit crimes, they should be held accountable. I don't think that they're anywhere close to the security threat that organized white supremacy hate is. And they are not comparable. They're not good people on both sides. You know, one is an existential threat to American democracy, and the other one is some pissed off kids And if they break windows, charge them with breaking windows. Next. Okay. You know, so that's the way I think about it. I mean, and let me just tell you this, this whole defund the police thing, which I was never for. In fact, there are Scopes articles showing how I was never for defund the police.
I was going to get to that.
Well, let me just jump the gun. Let me tell you, Mike Johnson, you know who he is? He's a speaker.
Yeah, he's the mayor of Dallas.
He's a speaker of the House of Representatives in the United States.
Oh, that guy. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Other Mike Johnson.
Right.
He wants to cut the ATF, the FBI, and the DOJ. Is he defund the police? I think he is. Let me tell you, defund the police was an unfortunate term used by some. Hear me out now, Glenn, before I lose you. In the wake of the murder of George Floyd, there were some very angry young people who I believe had a reason to be upset. And they used some, what I think, irresponsible language, which then got weaponized into some national rhetoric. I don't know one Democratic politician who ran on the banner of defund the police. Why? Because it's stupid, right? Now, I will say that we should pay care to the budget of the Department of Recreation, Education, school lunches, after school programs. If we cut all those programs and send the money to the police department, we're not doing the upstream preventative work that we could be doing. So there is a budget conversation to be had about what's the proper allocation, right? But defund the police was dumb, is dumb, and mostly it was blown out of proportion by the right wing. I was in Wisconsin. They were accusing Mandela Barnes of defund the police. I'm like, what? So it got politicized to a very high degree.
Do you think there's a problem with police morale issues, not just in Minneapolis, but around the country?
Yeah, there is. There is. And we've got to do something about it. But I'm going to tell you what I think we should do about it is that we should say that high standards are important. See, a lot of people want to say public criticism of policing is why we have bad morale. I would say to you that Derek Chauvin is the reason we have bad morale. Those five guys who killed Tyre Nichols is the reason we have bad morale. If I got a minute to tell you a story about a good police officer and the way the department handled the situation hurt morale. So there's a woman named Carrie L. Horn. And 20 years ago, she and her white male partner went into a house, made some arrests. She cuffed her person. She walked him out. And she noticed that the other guy was still in there. So she goes in there. And this guy is banging on a cuffed defendant, or he's not even a defendant yet. He's just a suspect. And she tries to verbally intervene, and then she tries to physically say, you cannot beat this man like this. You know, he punches her. She's like, you know, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. You violated departmental policy. You're not supposed to do this. Well, somebody got in trouble. It was her. She ended up getting investigated and fired. And she didn't get her pension restored till about 2 years ago. Carrie L. Horn. Now, in the meantime, the officer who beat this suspect ends up getting caught doing it again and gets charged with a federal civil rights crime and does prison time for it. I'm saying that the way back to police morale is to say, look, if you obey the rules of this department, there's very, 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 very little chance that you're going to end up in trouble. And then we need to recruit other. And I think we recruit too heavily around people with like military backgrounds. I mean, look at policing today. Look at how much crime is caught up in, say, computers. Do you really need to be able to run a mile under 5 minutes to be a good computer, a cop that fights, internet crime? And what about rape and sexual assault? You need somebody with the level of sensitivity to interview those people who've been victimized that way. I mean, I think that our model for who's going to be a good cop has been male, has been military background, has been Caucasian in many times. And I think we need to expand our recruiting. I also think that we need to use technology more, particularly in terms of vehicle stop. Like if I run through a red light, that's dangerous. Well, do you need to get in a high-speed chase? Or do you just need to make sure that computer identifies that person and that person gets a ticket? Or there's a lot of ways we can reduce some of these very dangerous on-scene traffic stop situations. Now, sometimes police is going to be dangerous. I mean, you got mass shooters. You got some of these domestic calls, which can be very dangerous, and you're going to need, you know, somebody who can put some muscle mass and force on the situation. But I think we recruit too. We got plenty of people like that. We don't have people who are good in computers, who are good at you know, sympathy and empathy with victims. And I think we need to do more with that.
Okay. Listen, while we have you for a few more minutes, I want to change the subject slightly. Yeah, sure. You are one of the first Muslim members of the United States House of Representatives, if not the first. You are the first. There is a big controversy going on within the Democratic Party. Some people are calling the president Genocide Joe, and they're making life miserable for some Democratic politicians by objecting to U.S. policy in the war between Israel and Gaza. I'm wondering how you read that situation as a member of the Democratic Party and a professional politician with a presidential election that looks very, very close, just a few months away.
Right. Well, again, Glenn, I know that you and I aren't going to agree on this, but I think that President Trump is an existential threat to American democracy. I can name 10 reasons why I think so, but that's where I put it. So I think reelecting
Joe with you, team.
Right, right. So I think reelecting Joe Biden is fundamental and essential. And I think that Joe Biden has insisted upon humanitarian relief and has even called for a ceasefire and actually did not block the last ceasefire resolution in the United Nations. That's why Netanyahu canceled the visit. I also think that some people are naive about the U.S. relationship between United States and Israel. It's not based on one president. I think that if you want a change in that relationship, and what you want to see is that Israel and the United States relate much more like United States and the United Kingdom, United States and Canada. If you want to see that kind of arrangement where there can be disagreements, there can be arguments where if you don't do this, then we're going to do that. You want that. It's going to take more than one presidency. And you know, you got to give the people who are pro-Israel credit. They have been working hard on this for literally decades, and they have done a good job. And they're as successful as, well, actually, they're more successful than the NRA is because they've actually taken some setbacks. But they're a powerful group in terms of like, and it's not because of some anti-Semitic conspiracy. It's because of many years of work and relationship cultivation over a long period of time. And so I think that we do need a two-state solution. I think that Netanyahu is certainly bad for Israel and the United States. I think we need a new election, and we need somebody in Israel who sees that we can't do this every two or three years, back to, you know, the Israelis are fighting in Hamas in Gaza. We're going to have to come to a solution that is stable, and that means Palestinian state, democratic, peaceful, and working on solving the problems of their people, like food, water, clothing, shelter, things like that.
So you tell your colleagues on the left of the party to stand down and not jeopardize Joe Biden's reelection?
I don't tell them stand down. What I tell them is that my opinion is Joe Biden needs to be reelected. Joe Biden is willing to talk about how the United States can support its ally Israel and have a Palestinian state. And I remind them that it was Trump who said, let's have a Muslim ban. It was Trump who said, finish the job when asked about Gaza. It was Trump who, falsely said that Muslims were celebrating at 9/11. And I mean, do you talk about jumping out of the frying pan into the fire? Come on. Think about this. And then, you know, but look, but not, but on the other hand, Glenn, you are talking about people whose loved ones are being killed in Gaza. I got a good friend who I won't say her last name, but I'll say her first name. Her name is Hala. And she's a well-respected political activist in San Francisco. And she has had well over 100 members of her family killed and many more than that injured. So there is an emotional aspect to this that I just hope that we understand, which is why I didn't publicly attack people when they said uncommitted. I said, as long as you show up in November, we're good. If you need to vote uncommitted to send a message, I get it. Because you saw that in Michigan and in Minnesota, that message was sent. But at the end of the day, that's kind of how I feel about it. We got to return Biden to the White House.
Okay, thanks for that. And thanks for your time this morning. This is Keith Ellison. John, you want to add anything?
Actually, no. I think this is a good round session.
Can I say this as I wrap up?
Yeah.
First of all, you can get Break the Wheel anywhere books are sold. It's the true story. It's what really
Fair enough.
Hey, man. There you go. And then
I have my copy with me. But.
Well, and then also let me say that, look, while I would be open to having a truthful, fair dialogue with a person like Liz Collins, it's hard for me to see how a conversation wouldn't devolve into an argument pretty fast. But you guys are able to talk to her and you can talk to me. We can disagree in an agreeable way. Nobody here has been insulted or been treated unfairly. And I think that in this moment of political polarization, you guys are play a very important role. Now, if you follow my political commentary, you know I don't mind ripping somebody a new one if they got one coming. I'm being sincere. I think you guys are doing a good service. I've listened to some of your stuff, and I'm on the conclusion now that I think that you guys have an important role to play in terms of trying to get people into some conversations that they're just not going to be into, unless somebody with your credibility on both sides does that. I tell people don't dismiss them because they're, I know you're not a black conservative, John, but don't dismiss them because they don't agree with some of the things we say. Listen to them, take them seriously, don't take what they say personally, and I hope you guys keep at it and have more people from my side of the political fence on, because while you may not agree on a lot of things, you might actually shed some light, because a lot of conservatives do watch your show. And they'll be like, oh, I thought that person was completely crazy. Now I kind of, they're not completely crazy. They're just sort of crazy. You know? So, anyway, that's all I got to say. Well, thank y'all for having me on, okay?
Thanks very much, Keith. We really appreciate it, man.
You got it.
Thanks a lot for those last words are meaningful and gratifying to me.
All right, well, take care of yourself.
This was great.
Take care.